Welcome to the fourth meeting of Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters. We turned in ticket number 554 for today. And as I will tell you a little later, we just passed the 600 mark in our membership. Someday we should have a drive and get a few members. I would like to first give you a couple of commercials. One is a reminder to watch Channel 4, 7:30 on December 15th for something that pertains to all of us. It's called From the Cat Whisker to the Peacock. And it takes you all the way from you-know-where to right up to today and should be very interesting. Channel 4, 7:30, December 15th. I'm asked also to remind all of us who belong to this group that RTRA has its charity drive on now and is closing very soon. I would ask that those of us who have not done so already get your either your pledge or your check in to RTRA. I'm happy to report, even though Don Quinn is not with us today, as we promised in a letter, that Don is coming home next week from the hospital, and I think that's good news for all of us. And Don asked that I ask you to thank you for all the cards, letters, and communications that came to him while he was in the hospital. Now, for the benefit of you who are new here, I'd like to just take us back 1 year to the month of November 1965. At that time, we had 179, which was a record for that date, in attendance at our meeting at the Continental Hotel. It was a meeting of an organization called the Broadcast Pioneers. The Broadcast Pioneers was formed in 1942 by H.V. Kaltenborn in New York, and it took several years for it to get out here, as it does, of course, many things from New York to here. But it came, and our first president is one of our loyal board members and hardest workers, Mr. Van Newkirk. Stand up, Van, right here on my left. I somehow or other left town for a few weeks and came back to find myself the president of the Broadcast Pioneers shortly after that time. And it turns out that that's a pretty sneaky way to get a guy. But I'm not much on reading bylaws and constitution, but somehow or other I didn't have anything to do one day, and I sat down and I read it. And it turns out that the New York was taking 75% and we were keeping 25%. And I got mad, and everybody got mad with me. So as a result, we explained to the assembled 179 that we had asked New York for a reversal or some sort of a change. We waited. We heard nothing from New York. So we withdrew and seceded from the organization and formed the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters and had our first meeting on January 28th. And I want to give you the history because I am backed up by so many loyal people, and they're right here in front of me. All of you who have joined and been so loyal as to come out to all the meetings. Our man on the right-hand side here, Mr. Dresser Dahlstedt, is our membership chairman, and he's been meaning to put on a drive for members, haven't you, Dresser? Never got around to it. But if any of you who are not members want to become members, of course, we're happy to have you as members, and a membership blank will be at the desk as you go out. The $10 that you pay will pay not only for your initiation, but for all of 1967. Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters is a nonprofit corporation founded under the state of California laws and put together by another one of our fine members and board, Mr. Bob Myers. Bob, if you're there somewhere, I would like to have you stand up so we can thank you in person. There he is, right over there. Well, we knew we had a bunch of swingers from the start, and I guess everybody likes a rebel cause, because then we went on to bigger things and had our next meeting on April Fool's Day in 1965. The gathering seemed to get bigger every time, and part of that was due to the chairman of our program. All of our programs have been put together or engineered by a man by the name of Harfield Whedon from CBS, and he's right here on my right. And what this group would have done without him, I can't tell you. It's just been great. Thank you, Harfield. We've had some excellent meetings. As you know, last time, our third meeting, we got together a couple of old friends of yours that hadn't seen each other in a number of years, Lum and Abner. And we had a pretty good wild one that time, I'll tell you. That was the first time we met in this room. As a matter of fact, I think we practically christened this place. At that time, we had about 400 members, and now, as I say, we just passed 600 today. We were asked about our purpose. Well, we decided that we better organize first and get our feet under the desk, which we have done. But seemingly, someone was shining down on us because a purpose has come to us in the form of somebody to step into the breach with the Hollywood Museum having had its problems, somebody to step in and save all the memorabilia, the records, the transcriptions, the scripts, and old radios and things like that, that were surely being thrown out daily by all of us here and other people in town. We have tried to do our best to save some of this, and I plead with you, and I have mentioned it in letters to the members, make sure you continually be on the lookout for material of any kind, records or old transcriptions, phonograph, magazines. It makes very interesting reading for posterity, and as you know, posterity is just around the corner. So anyway, we would like to have you be aware of this and save these things for us. A man who has been elected by the Board of Directors to the head of the Acquisitions Committee. He has the title of Director of Acquisitions is Mr. Marty Halperin. I'd like to have Marty stand up so everybody can see him. We already have received from J. Walter Thompson, through the kindness of our lovely friend Francis, a very... It's 81 bound volumes of the Lux Video Theater. That's a start, and we already had to hire the hall down at Beacon's Van and Storage, so we at least have some very safe, special storage for this material. We do not ask you to give it willy-nilly. We just want to preserve it so that it will not be thrown into the ash can. We're not trying to do the museum out of a job. If they come back into being full swing, boy, they have our blessing. They can have all of this stuff. And we're not also trying to do the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences out of anything that they do. And I understand they have a museum. But mainly, this is to preserve radio. And we'll give the Television Academy all the television material that they can have. Now, I think our main purpose and theme still in Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, the fourth meeting, still should be the fellowship. And looking around here, I have a little better view of who's here than you do, and I don't dare mention anybody because I'd be here all night calling them out. But make sure that you see all of them because you know them, and they're all here. And we appreciate all of you coming out today. Now, this is a business meeting, and it'll take all of about 1 minute. Our nominating committee, you wonder what these papers are in front of you. Our nominating committee has met, and they have put together this slate for 1967. Now, I'd like to explain that we had 16 members on our board, and all 16, when asked if they would like to serve again, said yes. They are all at all the meetings. They're the swingingest, most loyal, hardworking board you could ever imagine. I don't know why, but they're there. They all want to serve for 1967, so we amended the bylaws to add 5. The nominating committee came up with the additional 5. We have 21, and we had to draw a line somewhere, as Harfield says. We put the line under there, 2 or 3 lines. That is in case we want to keep it democratic and nominate from the floor anybody else. And of course, if we have any motion to close the nominations or anything like that? Is there a second? Second. And I assume then that we will vote on moving the nominations closed and the secretary cast a unanimous ballot for the 21 before you. You can take them. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? I didn't think so. The ayes have it, and thank you very much. We are going to, we like to keep it very democratic, but you can see you'd have a little bit of a problem electing anybody with the chicken gravy all over everything. It would be a mess. We are, however, going to rotate this board for the benefit of you who think we are running something rather sneaky on you. Each year, we're going to try to take one-third of the board off and rotate them, if that'll make you feel any better. Now we'll let the noes, please withdraw those noes, and we'll be all right. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to also at this time thank all of those who, as I do each time, because they put in tremendous amount of time, those who take care of the luncheons, Lou Loria and his committee, and the tickets and the printing and the programs, etc. And we're very, very grateful to all of you who volunteer and serve in this capacity out there at the door. Our plans for next year, as you perhaps already know, start out with our annual meeting, our meeting at which we will inaugurate the officers to be later elected by the board. At January 26th, an evening meeting. That's so you can bring your husbands and wives and they will really see that there is a Pacific Pioneer Broadcaster and you don't take Friday and go somewhere where you're not supposed to go. We'll have it at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, the International Ballroom. It'll be $25 a couple, and we're asking that it be black tie optional, and that way the ladies don't have to put on the longest gown that they might not have. And we'd like to see you all there. And we have a fine program lined up. I would like to say we just got confirmation that Mr. Ralph Edwards will be there with his entire group, Jack Bailey, Bob Barker, Steve Dunn, and numerous others. The whole thing will be put together by our perennial and permanent master of ceremonies, Pat Buttram. And we'll hear more about him in just a moment. We also made some notation in the last letter about a charter flight. There seems to be some interest in taking this group or taking part of this group and going to Europe. And of course, as you know, charter flights are rather economical and easy to come by. And if we have enough people, say 165 people, which would only be about 70 couples or so, 75 couples, we would be able to go to Europe. So I would ask that you give your name, address, and phone number on a card to me stating your preference as to date and destination, and we will let you know further. At this time, ladies and gentlemen, if I may have your attention, I would like to introduce Colonel Robert Cranston of the Armed Forces Radio and Television Network. A little group that we've all worked for from time to time, we're very proud of for the job they're doing. He has a very special presentation to be made at this time. I'd like to present Colonel Cranston.
Thank you very much. I'm one of these people like the pioneers who took many years to get out here. But I'm here now, and I would like to say one thing, that on the way out here, I was born in London and passed through Texas where I was raised, so you'll have to please excuse the accent. And looking over the people here, I really have to say one thing before I go into what I have written down here. And that is, this is really an Armed Forces Radio Alumni Association. I think everybody here has either been associated with it in one way or the other, or they've been assigned to it, or they've been on some of the programs. And if I started naming people, I would be here quite for a long time, and I've been asked to be short. So I'll just restrict my remarks today to one of the group who we are here to honor. It has been said that Chick McGregor should have been the first officer in charge of Armed Forces Radio Service, but old Tom Lewis already had nailed that title down. And Chick did everything that Tom could do, though he did it with a generous flair that is well known to many of you. Chick set the precedent of providing the armed forces with programming, which he loaned to us at first. Musical selections from his library were heard in many places all over the world before the War Department had decided for sure that this business was just a lot more than foolishness. Since there were no rules to stop him in his enthusiasm, he even loaned us people, and some of you are here that were loaned to us. Experienced broadcasters who were sharing this enthusiasm with Chick and with those in the military broadcasting business. These gentlemen may not believe this, Chick, but I happen to know that you even paid their salaries while some of your people were working for us. There were many things needed besides programs and studio space, both of which Chick provided freely. Some of our pioneers tell me that they were even sitting on C.P. McGregor's chairs, and when they got tired, they slept in his studio. I don't know how he segregated them, but... It was true that Chick was deeply concerned for the morale of American men at war far from home, but he was concerned with the morale of those in the Armed Forces Radio Service itself. He published a newsletter which kept all of our people up to date on where their colleagues were, a practice which we continue to do until this day through our newsletter. There are many people who took part in these activities, starting in the days when the Armed Forces Radio was nothing more than a kit containing a phonograph and some of Chick's music. Tom Lewis, whom I've already mentioned, is one. Judy Fogle, Vic Kwan, Andy Schrade, George Jones, and many, many more, some of whom are with us today, as I mentioned before. As a symbol of our profound thanks to them, and as a sincere thank you to Chick McGregor, who has helped us so much for so many years and continues to do so right now, I'm pleased to present this plaque to you, Chick, along with a Good Things Come in Smaller Packages item.
This is one you didn't know about.
Colonel Cranston, Art Gilmore, fellow members of AFRA, and guests. It certainly is a great thrill for me to be here today to accept this award, and I can truthfully say that I'm eternally grateful and very proud that I had a little small part in the Armed Forces Radio Service. As you know, they are still entertaining some 1,500,000 people throughout the world. And thanks to you people, and the networks, and all of the people that have given of their time and the services for free, I want to thank you very, very much. This is practically 25 years that we've been in this business, and to look around the table, you mentioned a few minutes ago that you were looking for programs, and if you think some of you were pretty good 25 years ago, come on down to my studio because I have most of your voices and I can tell you right now how you sounded in those days. I was a little reluctant to join the Pioneer Club because I didn't think I was quite old enough. But after looking around the room to Janet Waldo and Jane Webb over here and Ann Whitfield and some of the rest of you, I thought perhaps that I was old enough, so I'm delighted to be one of your charter members. Just one other thing. When I went home after talking with Colonel Cranston, who, by the way, is a broadcaster, his dad was the manager of WPAP and WBAP in Fort Worth, Texas, up until a few years ago, and so he knows the radio business. And you know, I went home to my wife, Mildred, and I said, "Honey, how many important people do you think there's in the show business here in Southern California? I've just been awarded the first civilian award that they've ever given the Armed Forces Radio Service to a civilian." And she said, "Well, honey, I really haven't the faintest idea, but there's one thing I do know. There's one less than you think." Colonel Cranston, thank you very, very much. I appreciate this dearly. It'll be up on the wall, and when you come on over to my studio, I'll be delighted to show you where it is, and come on over and hear yourself sometime. Thank you.
Yeah, baby. Thank you, Chick. Thank you, Colonel Cranston. You know, there's a loyal pioneer here with us today who retired recently. Now, if you retire like this man, boy, I'll tell you, you won't be in a rocker, that's for sure. So I'd like to introduce the man who's now off his rocker. No, he's a fine fellow and a great guy to boot. Mr. Murray Bolin, who is chairman of our day. Chairman?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
He says he was just kidding, I hope so. Arthur, thank you. CP, I hope you destroyed my master.
No, I haven't.
I guarantee it's before anyone that was cut in this hall. Was it?
Well, you and Phil Harris.
Phil Harris is with me. Okay. Thank you very much, Arthur, and I'll guarantee you I'll be as brief as anything. But for just 1 second, I'd like to do something that's a little bit personal and might ring a bell with some of you broadcast pioneers. There's a gal sitting out here that is a real radio pioneer, as most of you know her, I think. She was once, a production assistant for Bill Baecher, and she went through every kind of radio you can think of and was an assistant to me. But for the last 25 years, she's been the office manager of Benton and Bowles. That's an advertising agency. From which plant this week she will retire. And you use the retire on me, Arthur, okay. Anyway, this gal will retire. And she goes out the retirement route, and anyone that can last 25 years at Benton and Bowles deserves something I've been. And I should know. For just 1 second, would you wish a happy landing to Miss Mary Edith Stahl? Bam, where are you? Thank you all very much. Love you, Bam. And if you look on Highland Avenue, if you go back into Hollywood, you will see a sign that says, "We love Bam" on it. And if you wonder what it is, that's it. Now, flyer or the program set up for today named me as chairman of the day, unquote. Literal translation, be the fellow who delivers a guest of honor for the day, unquote. Well, I did that, and I think I produced a real dandy type fella for the honor guest, but I don't even get to introduce him. That's for other people. And that'll be done in a minute with the proper adjectives and all that. So I did what I thought was the next best thing, and to me introducing him yet. And I put the bug on, again, on one of our very favorite people whom Arthur has already mentioned. And here he is, Mr. Pat Buttram.
Thank you. The reason they have me, I'm one of the few on one of the few television shows that hadn't been canceled this year, and they figured that they could. And I wanted to come back this time to properly introduce Rudy Valley. I could. Thank you, Rudy. There he is. Great. But I'll tell you, it's a kick for me to look around and see all these old familiar voices. If we just didn't have to listen to all these old familiar faces, we'd be all right. But this proves a fact I've said for years. Radio is not dead. It sure as hell is ready for Medicare, I'll say that, but it's going to be a great day here today. We've got the show of the year for you. And you know what kind of a year this has been. It's boy, it hadn't been too good a year for some of us. I know this is a year like I did a lot of stupid things. I opened up a little place down in Watts, a little bar, and called it Whitey's Place. You know what I mean? This
is... cut that out.
Awful. And it's been like that all year, everything. For instance, my secretary, she got her saccharin pills mixed up with her birth control pills. Now she has the sweetest baby in town. Terrible. And, of course, this is a year that has proved definitely that movies are better than ever. And if you don't believe it, just tune in television any night of the week. We have some fine people here. A friend of mine I'd like to introduce, Hal Cantor, a great writer here.
Yeah,
and Hal, he's... He has a little sideline. He sells dirty remarks to the kids that want to be on the Art Linkletter show. Oh, another person is here. You know, the strike is on, and we can't do TV commercials, so Olin Soule is here with us. It couldn't work. And that strike is more serious than you think about the commercials. We're not going to pick it. What they're going to do is little things like the White Knight is going to back up and dirty everybody. And Katie Winters is not going to tell her friends, you know. And the guy that has the bad, bad breath, they're going to turn him loose at a concert down at Music Center. And what the Dove's going to do to Mrs. Green's kitchen, I wouldn't tell you that. But you remember years ago in this business, we had terrible times. We had just a small group. We'd get together and sit down in negotiations with the network, and they'd tell us what they were going to do to us. Now we've got a big, strong union. We sit down with the network, and they tell us what they're going to do to us. Oh, I tell you. Makes us wish we had Ronnie back, you know. You know, that's one thing. California is a beautiful state, very generous. You realize we're the only state in the union that gives our governor on-the-job training. You're doing it. No, I don't want to get into that because Ronnie is a friend of mine. He's great. I don't mind spending an evening with Ronald Reagan. But 4 years, my God. No. Oh, another announcement. We want to thank the teenagers for letting a lot of you drive down Sunset Strip to get here today. And I've got a joke here about Pandora's box that could change this into a fishing boat. I'm not going to use that. It's, I don't want to,
we'll be rated for
it. We won't. I don't want to set too much of an example for failure. Yeah. Announcement that they gave us here to make, to thank the, people for letting us use the room here. The San Fernando Valley Wife Swapping Club was the name. No, they say that Ventura, out here in the valley, it's just one big street of vice, Ventura. But what the hell can you expect when a street starts out with Tail of the Cock and in the middle they got the Wild Goose? And you wind up in the Queen's arms. I don't know. It's terrible. But it's real fitting and honoring today. It's proper, I think, that we should meet here at this Sportsman's Lodge right here in the middle of the San Fernando Valley to honor our guests today. We're located here in a perfect place, just a stone's throw from Grace Hayes' lodge across there, you remember? And Charlie Foy's around the corner. And we have a great guest of honor who has really years and years has been in radio, television, music. In fact, they say years ago when he heard that Marconi was tinkering with a new invention, he just went right out and learned all the words to do-wah-diddy. He was ready. And so a guy that, of course, they kid about him a lot. They say that Phil has been stoned more often than our U.S. embassies overseas. It's not true. And a lot of degrading things they say about this great man. They say he would have had his own show on television, but NBC can't get a liquor license. And these things are not so, I know. We have a fellow, he's a very religious man. He's, every night he soaks his beads in Jack Daniels. And last time he went to confession 2 months ago, the priest is now a waiter at the Pink Pussycat. this man has a tender side to him. Today, one of our fellows here came up to him and said to him, said, Phil, have you ever thought of AA? And he said, not as much as they've thought of me. I've known Phil for years. I worked with him on his radio show, gave me one of the first jobs I had out here in California, and used to travel around with him. We were driving out one night to Charlie Foy's, and a cop stopped us. And it's about midnight, and Phil said the fault was, he said, the sun got in his eyes. And the cop said, it's midnight, how could that happen? And Phil said, if I could figure out those things, I wouldn't have to drink. But he's a... he's a very civic-minded man. I understand Phil is seriously considering, since the trend's going that way, of going to Alabama and running for governor. Not for the job. He's going to run for the governor herself. He may... But it's great to honor a man like this that through the years has been a great citizen. He's worked hard, has a wonderful marriage, and it's lasted real great. The papers, you know, full of these things. You see the other day that Eddie Fisher, his lawyers have told him that he's still married to Elizabeth Taylor. And boy, does he have grounds for divorce, I'll tell you this. this is a guy that has lived through the days Hollywood was glamorous. I remember in the days when Alice and Phil would go out together and everybody would comment, remark about the beautiful long curls and the fur cape and the diamonds, and they'd say, and Alice looks pretty good too. But he's I'd like to introduce him with the fact that he has settled down and is really is a great credit to the industry. He's always helps all of us that he can. And I'd like to introduce him with the words that his grandchildren, his little grandchild, said when he first learned to talk and looked up and saw Phil and uttered the words, "I love you, old granddad." And that's the way we feel today. We love you, granddad. Phil Harris. Here.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. President, I'm going to tell you something, Pat. I've never been put in a spot like this in my life. If I could have my choice of following somebody other than him, it'd have to be Cougat. I often wonder how terrible it is for all those Mexican chihuahuas to be in a broken home, you know. I want to thank all of you nice ladies and gentlemen for being here, because I'm taking credit for it. And it's nice of you to show up, because I know you don't owe me anything. And it's like I once told Sheldon Leonard, when Alice and I had a program, he came over and wanted to do bit parts. And I'm smart. I said, "I can't use you on radio. You look too Jewish, you know." But they tell me to function like this, that the way to be an instantaneous hit is to say something very complimentary about an important person. So screw Charles de Gaulle. want to thank our president, Mr. Art Gilmore, for asking me here, but this is murder, man, to get up and try to be funny in front of a bunch of... I've never seen so many wonderful, well-known faces since I last time I had a picnic at Forest Lawn. But I've got a bunch of notes that I've been working on here. I became so frightened when Murray Bolin and Art and all these people told me I was going to come here, and I had so much funny stuff written down here on the paper that I've been working on for a couple of weeks, but in the last 15 minutes I breathed on it and I can't read a goddamn... It's awfully nice to see all of these familiar faces, you know. And I look down and I see my good friend Rudy Valley. You put me in the goddamn spot. 25 years I've been married to Alice. And now I see her brother here, Bill Fay. Now, this is the worst mistake that could ever be. Both of us away and nobody watching her money. But I've always loved Rudy Valley. You know, many years ago when I first met him, the sheriff made him marry his daughter, you know. And he used to come into a place called the Lafayette. I was working in the Lafayette, this is many years ago, on West 7th Street. A guy by the name of Harry Miller used to have it. So he used to get all them oil men, I don't know who the guys were, a guy named Sinclair, somebody used to get him up. Julian, the guy's name was. And he had a private room where he used to take Julian. Julian used to get boxed out, you know. And he wanted to hear fiddle and everything. We had no fiddle. I had Red Nichols playing, and they brought Red Nichols out. Henry Halstead brought Red Nichols out, and Red came because he thought he was coming to San Francisco, see, because... But we blew that job. This is while he was on the train. So, now he's hacked. He don't know nothing about L.A. because he wants to see his sister and everybody. And he comes out and I said, have you got a cornet mute? He says, why? I said, because they got a guy named Julian that they bring in here every night and he gets gassed. And they take him into a separate room. And I said, you play in his ear Roy Fox style. And I said, the guy's going like a bear, you know. Because they won't let me in. I'm a drummer, see? But I know when he comes out, he's got a pocket full of money. Now, Halstead and a guy named Harry Miller, they frisk you the minute you come out, see? And they cut it up, and I said, now watch. I said, the guy's going to give you $200 or $300 when you go in there. Put it in your watch pocket. And when you come out, cut it up with me. I want that mute, you know, whispering. He can play, because I can't get in there. So, I don't know where I'm going. So anyway, oh, yeah. So, that Jack Daniels gives you a lot of false courage, you know. So anyway, Rudy was out here at that time, and he used to come up and listen to the band. We had what you call a paper hat band in those days, you know. I mean, you get up and I stole it from Irving Aronson, you know, Singing in the Rain and all them things, you know, with Phil Sax and Red, the trombone player, and everybody. You know, you had to do something. You couldn't just play, you know what I mean. You had to either go back to the barn or keep it moving some way. So Rudy came in, and he loved the band. You know, he used to come in, sit every night, bring his own whiskey. The only way you'd know he's there, you'd hear him bitching about a beverage charge, you know. And I'd look over, and there he was. He had a big silver shaker, you know. I don't know what it was full of. Anyway, he says, I like your band, kid. So he goes back now and he opens a Pennsylvania Roof, you know. This is when he's on that Fleischman program, you know, making more money than he could count. And they got that big lodge up there, you know, he's got a big lodge up in Massachusetts someplace. So everybody loved Rudy Valley, you know, I still love him. And he said, look, I'm going back to New York. If anything happens, I like your band. And he said, I'm going to send for you. So sure enough, he sent for me. But Ralph Hitz was a good friend of mine, see, because I used to run around with guys like Maceo and a lot of Dagos, see, with the mafia. Because I didn't have any talent, but I knew who had... So he said, take him or I'll kill you. So... You talk about Grauman's Chinese. I had guys that put their feet in cement they ain't heard of since. So anyway, I'm hustling. So Jimmy McCabe gives me a job up in the St. Francis Hotel. This is 1929. This is after Valley left. He says, I'm going back to New York, but I like your band, kid. And compared to him, I was a kid. So, I said, yes, sir. So, anyway, I opened a St. Francis Hotel in 1929. Now, this is the bad year. This is when, what do they call it, that Giannini, that stock, what do they call it, that went down to nothing, and all them Dagos are jumping out windows and everything, you know, killing each other. Ain't nobody got $8. So I'm up there, and I've got to get 30% over, too, you know. So I go in there, and now they're lined up in front of the St. Francis Hotel waiting to get to the Mark Hopkins to hear Anson Weeks. That's what kind of trouble I'm in. They say, dancing with Anson, you know. Now, this shit, he's got a band. He's got a band where they take a piano sheet, and then they all get together and learn the number, you know. Rough going, man. Guy used to bring that microphone in, you know, a big thing like this with wires all over it, and set it up and said, you're on. I said, I was just on 8 minutes ago. He says, I know, but we ain't got nothing to fill in here. Go on, you know. So anyway, and the drummer with Anson Weeks is using a heel pedal. You can hear this to Sacramento, you know. Because the guy don't allow nothing but afterbeat, Anson Weeks. So anyway, I'm up there, and we're not doing any business, see? It's rough, man. We got two old ladies living there, and they're eating there, and then people used to come in, and they say, we're going to, up now, we've eaten, we're going up to the Mark Hopkins and dance. So, anyway, so now the first thing you know, I have a man by the name of Abe Frank that used to run the Coconut Grove, nice man. I used to sit in, and he hated Music Corporation. Pretty smart Jew, huh? So he told me, he says, look, he says, there's a bunch coming out from Chicago. He says, I used to be in South Bend, Indiana, and he says, this is an octopus. And he says, I don't want nothing to do with them. Because he says, I put my own bands together. He used to go in, listen to Lyman, Arnheim, all them guys, and I had to follow Bing, you know, and what they call them, the Rhythm Boys, you know. Oh, what a beautiful bunch that was. That's when they used to have to throw a net over Bing, you know. And a guy by the name of Lloyd Bacon used to have to take him out in the ocean, you know, where he couldn't swim back, you know what I mean. So I go in there, so they tell me, they say, well, Jimmy Greer, God rest his soul, was playing with Arnheim, and he had the band. They said, you're going to last 2 weeks, so do it good, you know. So anyway, I go in there, and I start to work, and I did pretty good. It was during the Olympics. It was 1932, and that's when I finally found Lee Ray. Friend of mine by the name of Artie Mellinger. I'm just coasting if you want to go somewhere. So a guy named Artie Mellinger was a song plugger for Harms. He came in, he says, I got a niece, whatever you call him. And he says, she's about 16 years old. I said, let me know when she's 17. He says, no, he says, she sings. She comes from Norfolk, Virginia. So he brought it out. So the way it happened, we stayed about a year and a half during the Olympics. It wasn't the fault of the band. It was just that, you know, nobody could get a room. You know, everybody was in there. So anyway, all of a sudden, I get ready to go to New York. Now, and this time, I've never been to New York before. So I go to Tom Grenovich, good friend of mine, because I started in San Francisco many, many years ago, 1924 to be exact. And I worked with Walter Cross, where we opened the balconades on Market Street. And the first time I did, I'm sleeping in the Union busted, because I got busted out in Honolulu, you know. They brought a guy named Francis Brown, who was a very good friend of mine, brought over a girl named Leatrice Joy. She just made a thing called the White Monkey. Pretty good. So, this is a picture. No, it's on a level. So now they said to me, now I come from Nashville, Tennessee, see, so they had five-piece Dixieland band. So I was working first in Denver, Colorado. That's when I followed Joe Frisco. And Joe Frisco at that time was getting $1,500 a week. This is about 1923. And so anyway, the organist there, a guy named Ed Sawtell, he says, I'm going over to Honolulu for Conn and Greenfield, and I'm going to open a theater. It was all on one incline. There was no balcony. It was an inc- And he says, I want you kids. I was just, you know, first year high school. And we're out of the thing. Well, that's pretty good. They tell me that Regan don't have a lawyer's degree. I love the way when he came out the other day, Rudy, with his advisory staff. He's got 10 guys, Regan, on his advisory staff. The first two guys are Wasserman and Schreiber. In 5 years from now, this will be Jewel Stein, California. But it's all right with me. I don't care, as long as Alice don't go busted. But anyway, where was I? Oh. Yeah, old man Frank. Is that where I was? So, anyway, so now it comes time to go to New York. But in the meantime, through these dagos, I'm a very good friend of Ralph Hitz. And Ralph Hitz was a tough man. Ralph Hitz is the man that started the National Hotel chain. He's the guy that told Clark, the singer, he says, get out of my house. And the guy wanted to marry his daughter, you know. So the guy finally married his daughter, and he had him killed. So anyway, well, he didn't have him killed. He just had the plane run out of gas. And had the guy standing up when they hit. Pretty good. So anyway, how long you want, Jack?
Whatever you want.
So anyway, I go back to New York, and Music Corporation says there's only one thing you're going to... Oh, this is a very cute story. And I think it's very interesting because although I've been, you know, trying to be funny and everything about MCA and Mr. Jewel Stein, Mr. Jewel Stein is one of the nicest men I ever met in my life. I spent 30 years with Music Corporation. And when I was in any trouble, I remember when Wasserman, I remember from Barnett, I remember from Schreiber. Now, when Schreiber first came out, after old man Frank told me, he wasn't allowed on the grounds at the Coconut Grove because Mr. Frank didn't like that. Mr. Frank built his own bands. He built bands with Abe Lyman, he built bands with Gus Arnheim, and if a guy could play, it didn't make any difference how much money he wanted, Mr. Frank would give it to him. And he came into all rehearsals when he'd get an arrangement. This is when the saxophone player is getting $125 a week, see, and we're only getting 80. But he only has to make three arrangements a week, the guy that's getting 125, see? But he's not scoring, he's just starting from the first trumpet part, Pete. So anyway, I used to meet Schreiber across the street at the Gaylord. He lived at the Gaylord. This is before they started the first office down on Olive in Alexander Oviatt building. So he used to call me over and he says, hey, how are you? You know what I mean? Well, I know that Fiorito owes him more than I can ever pay him. So there ain't no reason for me to try to make up with this cat, you know, Schreiber. So anyway, when they start, Jewel Stein, what I told you about, what a beautiful man he was, Minna Wallace was my manager at that time. Now, we were two fellas that were getting along pretty good. And we go up, and now Jules Stein comes up to San Francisco before I go into the Coconut Grove, and he says, I'd like to have you go with the Music Corporation. And I said, well, I said, I'm going down to Coconut Grove because, see, Music Corporation is not allowed in this town. Not as long as Abe Frank is there. Not because he didn't like them, but because he knew that this... Well, you'll find out in a couple of years. So anyway, and not astute, you know, this is nothing illegal. I mean, a man that goes out and goes in the toy business and goes in the furniture business and brings over every goddamn thing. You know, you go over to England now, you can't find nothing but wallpaper. You know, he's brought all the antiques over here. So anyway, Jules Stein comes up to me, and he walks into me, and he says, hi, Phil. You know, so I said, hi. So he said, I'd like to have you join Music Corporation. I'd love to have you come with us. So I already talked to Tom Granovitz, see? And Tom Granovitz said to me, I said, Tom, I said, if I go east, I've never been east in my life. I said, Rudy Valley's asked me to come east. He wants me to come east. And he's offered me a pretty good job, and I said, what should I do? He said, what am I going to tell you? What am I, Tom Graham, you know, Garen. He says he had Woody Herman and the guy that married Alice, what's his name, John Moore, some kind of, I don't know what it is. So anyway, I wish that Christ they hadn't have beefed. So anyway, he says, I'd like for you to go with us. I said, okay. And I said, I don't want to go. I said, I'm all right with Minna Wallace. But to show you the caliber of man that Jules Stein was, and this is one of the things that will always remain in my memory. He said to me, I said, what are you going to pay me? He says, I don't know what I'm going to pay you because I'd never been east. I'd never been anywhere. And I was just getting ready to go to Coconut Grove. And Mr. Jules Stein looked at me and he says, I'll tell you what I'll do, Phil. I'll give you $500 a week for the rest of your life. And I turned it down. Smartest thing I ever did. I don't know why, because I was busted at the time. And you know what guys like, but I'm just going to show you how things happen in this business, you know. I mean, how wonderful, you know, when you're really hustling and everything. So now, to get along, Rudy Valley's playing at the Pennsylvania Roof. And at this time, he's making more money than he can count. And he said, when he left the Pennsylvania Roof, of course, it was rough. I can remember when Guy Lombardo, if they had 15 people on top of the Starlight Roof at the Waldorf, they had a big night. He said, there's only one guy can follow me, and that is Phil Harris. So when I left the Coconut Grove, I went to Galveston. I played for my friend Sam Maceo. And I went into New York, and I opened the Pennsylvania Roof. And Rudy and Alice were there on my opening night. And she had a patch on her eye. She looked like Ichabod Crane. So I walked over, and he introduced me to her. I don't remember name with it. It's just another girl, you know what I mean? At that time, whew, how sweet I was. So anyway, I go in. Now Hitz gets mad at me. But the only thing I'm trying to live up to, it's awfully nice to see you here, Rudy. And I'll always remember when he came in and he loved the band, and I've always had the highest esteem for Rudy Valley, because he was one of our original radio artists. I think that he had more listeners than Godfrey. I think he was one of the real pioneers of radio, and he's always been one of my closest friends. And I will say this to you, ladies and gentlemen, he's the only man I ever met in my life that can eat one peanut, Mr. Rudy Valley. You know, I have another friend, Rudy, thank you. You were very good to me. Of course, Ralph Hitz hated me, would never give me a job after that because I opened the Pennsylvania Roof. Finally, I had to let my band go from New York because I was getting 30% over, and then you know, you're on a traveling thing. They came to me, they're walking out. They came to me, I don't blame you, honey. When I'm your age, when I have to go, I have to go. But anyway, All of these things are beautiful memories because I started with the Five Piece Dixieland Band in Nashville, Tennessee when I was going to school. I went over to Honolulu, I opened the Princess Theater. I was the first band that ever played there, and I get beautiful memories because I can remember when the Hawaiians, to show their appreciation, used to climb coconut trees and bring down coconuts and open them for us because, uninteresting, but this, well, you know, and then I used to get the okuliahau. I had a connection, but anyway, it just goes to show you there was never a band in Honolulu, and I can remember when we used to go from the Alexandria Hotel out to Waikiki Beach. It was all swampland, and at the time I was there, even downtown at the Alexander Young Hotel, you used to have to drop a net over you at night, you know, to keep the mosquitoes from eating you up, you know. So all of these things, and when I look out and I see all of you wonderful people, it's awfully nice to be here, and it's nice to reminisce. Am I taking too much time? Where's the whiskey? So tell the guy to bring me some. So anyway, but I opened the Pennsylvania Roof, and I was the biggest flop that they have ever had there. And then I went from there to the Pally Royal, and I played around New York, and I had Minna Wallace still, and then I came into a guy named Niles Tremmel, who was the president of NBC, and I used to take Minna Wallace in, and Minna Wallace used to do all the talking. Now, Niles Tremmel can't talk back to a woman, so I finally had to unload Minna because he said, I just can't do any business. Then they sent me down to West End Casino. I went down to West End Casino in West End, New Jersey, and Lyman, a bunch of people, they were trying to operate a thing, and they had a guy by the name of Bert Moss had a gambling boat down there, and I'd already played for him in Detroit in a place called the Addison Hotel. And when you start to reminiscing about, I can remember the first time, and I got a note here someplace, that was one of the nicest things that ever happened to me. When I was a kid, after we started at Balboa, this is my first job, I went to Balboa, and I'd been to Australia. I went over for the Phillips Brothers, and I opened a place called St. Kilda, the Pally de Dance at St. Kilda in Melbourne on the beach. And I came back, I'm a sideman now. This is when they're taking people over. This is after Frankie Ellis and Ray Tellier. And I went over, and instead of to show you how this business had advanced, I mean, I don't want to bore you, but anyway, they used to take whole bands over, Frankie Ellis, then they took Tellier, and now they get to the point to where the Australians are getting a little hip on how to play. So now they took five key men, and they took a guy named Loftner, they took a guy named Frank Remley, they took a kid named Chuck Maul, and myself to augment with Australians, and they used to have to put a sign up, just walk to the music, you see, because they knew nothing about this jazz. So when I got on a thing called the Ventura, 21 days it took me to get to Australia, and I'm going second class. And they got me in a place about as big as this thing here, and I'm on fire because I took 2 gallons of pure grain alcohol with me. Because, see, there's no whiskey in those days, and I'm drinking it with apricot cordial, so I got everybody drunk. I got everybody loaded on a boat the first couple of nights, so now they done put the guys in irons, everybody in irons, so I'm sitting up on the back of the boat, and a woman starts talking to me, says, you were getting your suits made when we all got killed in Gallipoli. Now, I'm from Nashville. I don't know nothing about it. Gallipoli, you know. I found out later it's around the Dardanelles or someplace. And I said, well, what the hell happened to you? She says, well, we were with the light horsemen. I said, sure, you got out in them goddamn boats and then hollered, here we are, you know, I mean. So now she gets in a big argument with me, so I can't argue with her. I can't argue with a woman. I get in the thing. This is when I'm a kid. Now the woman takes her shoe off and she's got a heel. Oh, Christ. She's got a heel, looks like a 10-penny nail she's got on the end of it, starts to hit me in the head, so I can't do nothing with her. So after she gets to hit me in the head, I pick her husband up, and I got him hanging over the boat. And they, where am I? So, so they slow me down. But anyway, what I started to tell you about, then I'm going to get the hell off of here. Oh, incidentally, I want to tell you that Dean Martin. I'm glad to see all these young guys coming up because Dean Martin is a fine, fine social drinker. And what I'm trying to tell you is about how radio first started. And I can remember one of my very close friends. He was a president of a bank in Beverly Hills. I'll never forget it. But he always loved jazz music. And I think that with music, that this is one of our great, great contributors to Dixieland. He went from president of a big bank in Beverly Hills. He went to a place called KNRC. At that time, it was a little radio station in the Elks Club on, what, 6th Avenue
or
Alvarado Street. And I think he's here tonight, and he put our little band, for the first time that I ever did a radio broadcast, was with Mr. Frank Bull, my close friend. Frank, will you stand up? Is Frank in there? There he is. I can remember when Mort Werner used to come by the Wilshire Bowl with a guy named Jess Oppenheim, and he used to say, Phil, please let us turn the thing on. It's awfully nice. I'm not going to stay on longer. It's awfully nice to be... Oh, Ray Singer, this is a beautiful thing. Now I get a radio program, and they got Conley and Mosier writing for me first. This with Julius Abruzzo and everything. Now, they're writing so dirty that I'm afraid to even carry it in my pocket. So I keep talking to him. I said, we got kids. You can't talk about this. He said, what are you talking about? I said, look, Joe, don't bring this in. Conley and Moses. So finally, I have to let them go. You know what I mean? Because the air won't take this kind of material they're putting on there. So then they go with Amos and Andy. They go with Amos and Andy, and I don't have to tell you what's happened to them later. But I'll show you what kind of guys happen. About 5 years later, they call me up and they say, Conley and Mosier say, we want you and Alice to have dinner with us. So I went and had dinner with them at Chasen's, and they looked over and they said, Phil, we want to apologize. See, they wouldn't take it from me because even though I'd been with Benny for 16 years, you can't build a 10-story building on tissue paper, you know, I mean. You got to be around. It takes time. And they said, we just want to apologize. We thought that we were the smartest guys in the world. Well, when they got with Amos and Andy and Gosden or Freeman, them guys, you know, Freeman Gosden looked at them and said, we don't want that. They took it out. But they wouldn't take it out with me. You understand what I mean? Well, they'd take it out, but not the material. So anyway, what I'm trying to tell you is that they said, we found out that you can write and be funny and still be clean. So after that, I hired a team called Singer and Chevalier, two of the greatest operators that ever lived. They went to work every morning just like a doctor or a lawyer. They'd go into their office, they'd work until 12 o'clock, they'd go have lunch over at the Beverly Hills Athletic Club. They'd take a little steam, take a little lunch, come back at 1 o'clock, and the script was always ready. But Singer was always putting in bagel jokes. So I kept telling him, I said, Singer, take the bagel jokes out, will you? Now, you know, with a writing team, you've always got one guy that says, I love you, and the other guy says, we ain't taking it out. You know, you got a fighter and a lover, you know. So Dick, you know, Chevalier, he's always saying, hey, baby. And the other guy's saying, this is funny. I said, what? What is funny? He says, all you got to do is say it. So anyway, I said to him, I kept saying, I said, now, Singer, this went on about 5 or 6 weeks. I said, I don't want no more bagel jokes because I got people through the Middle West, they tell me. You know what I mean? That's where your Nielsen or your whatever the hell it was comes from at that time. And I said, I don't want no bagel jokes. People don't know. My mother don't know bagels. They don't know bagels around where I come from. Leave the bagel jokes out. He says, you're crazy. They're funny. So I keep fighting with him. Now, one day I get a letter from a guy, and he's on 85th Street in New York. He writes a letter. He says, Phil, every week I listen to your program, you and Alice and the kids. He says, you got one of the greatest programs I ever listened to, but what is a bagel? This is a guy living at 85th Street in New York. Now, I got Merle here, see? Singer. So I can't wait. We get the reading. You know, used to go down 30 minutes before the show went off, and some guy upstairs come down, take half of it away from you, you know. So you had a cute gag. You put in three or four that you didn't need, see? You know, that you didn't want dirty gags, and say, well, I give you four, leave the rest of them in, you know what I mean? So anyway, I said to Fletchcom, now in front of the cast, I read this. And Frances Purcell is sitting over there, God love her, she was with me too. And I said, now I'm going to show you, singer, where I'm right. I said, here's a guy, he lives on 85th Street, and he loves the program and everything, but he says, why you keep saying bagel? Why you keep saying bagel? What is a bagel? Singer looked up at me and said, that's no problem, have him call my father. I just finished a picture. I'm going to get off of here. I just finished a picture, a thing with a very good friend of mine, Forrest Tucker, who is making F Troop. I'd like Forrest to take a bow. Sit up, Forrest. Forrest has been a friend of mine for many, many years, and I love Forrest, and I don't have to tell you what he's done, but he's doing a thing now, and he's doing a very good job at it. But anyway, while I'm doing this thing over the weekend, he goes down to Palm Springs. And he came back and he said, I just played a benefit down to a place where you're the honorary mayor down at Rancho Mirage. And I said, how'd you do? He says, well, I had Pat Buttram and everybody. He said, I killed them. I said, you did? He said, yeah, it was a big hit. I said, you were good. He said, yeah. He says, how could you miss? He says, well, I ain't no way, he says, I can miss. He says, I did 30 minutes on you alone. And I said, how? And he said, just falling down and getting up. It's awfully nice to be here. I'd like to mention a whole lot of names. I just want to tell you this. I think radio is here to stay. In fact, I'm pretty sure of it. Alice listens to it every morning, and this is a God's honest truth. Every morning when I wake up, she's got the radio on, and Arthur Godfrey. I said to her, after about 2 years, I wake up every morning with Arthur Godfrey, and I said, honey, why is it? Why is it every day that you got to have Arthur Godfrey on? She looked at me, and she said, Phil, every month he says something funny. I can remember when we first went into television, they said the picture business is going out of business. But now I can see where that it might take over television. And when we used to draw our own pictures in radio, we got a good chance of taking back pictures. So this might start right where we all started. And may I say in closing that if you're contemplating taking a trip to the moon, get a window seat. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil, and we all love you, Phil. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
And Pat, thank you again. As I say, you've been renewed more often than Run, Buddy, Run. Don't forget our next meeting, January 26th. We'll be in touch with you, but we'd like to have you circled on your calendar. If you are not a member, you may be one by just picking up a blank at the door. There are a couple of little things here. Gee, who is it? I'm going to be Susan Seaforth. Call home. Mr. Spears or Mrs. Spears, call home. Harvey Palish, call your office. How about this? Oh, and we have some lost glasses. You get outside, you'll know what hit you. Some glasses, and I'll keep them up here. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you on January 26th. Well,